Welcome to Educating Girls, a podcast produced by the Alliance of Girls Schools Australasia. I'm Lauren Bridge, the Executive Officer of the Alliance. Through our podcast, we'll be sharing insights and expertise from practitioners and education experts from around the world. And we'll cover important topics and issues related to the education of girls. In this episode, we revisit one of the outstanding keynotes of our 2021 Summit on Girls Education, delivered by award-winning journalist and author, Madonna King. Madonna's an expert on the issues confronting teenage girls. She's interviewed thousands of girls in the course of her research for her best-selling books, Being 14, Fathers and Daughters, and her latest book, Teenager. It's always fascinating to hear what's on girls' minds, and Madonna captures their voices so brilliantly in this presentation, covering everything from their views on changing the culture of the Australian Parliament to outnumbering boys in university engineering courses, from taking their place in boardrooms to still being paid less than men. Girls' voices are so important, but are they really loud enough? And do girls think they're being heard? Madonna gives us their responses. And just a listener note, this recording was made at the Summit on Girls' Education in May 2021. So please share this podcast and help us to amplify girls' voices and awareness for the issues affecting girls and girls' education.
So where do our girls sit in 2021? You know, Ava and Alexia, Tanya, Sienna, like the 2,000 or so girls whose counsel I've sought over the past couple of years, are swimming in a huge sea of opportunity. But whether they're 10 or 18, I think that with every stroke they take, they risk being swamped by waves. Waves of expectation, waves of disappointment, waves of self-judgment and anxiety. Their swimming skills are hampered early on by a lack of resilience or self-regulation, which we know is a strong predictor of later success. But this irony, where each opportunity risks being swamped by perhaps an even bigger challenge, is greater for this cohort than at almost any time in history. And it's against this backdrop. Social demographer Mark McCrindle believes that COVID will mould this generation of girls in the same way as World War II, the Great Depression, September 11, have shaped other generations. Hitting 10, when schools are shutting, when globally the economy moves into recession, and when all of the normalities of life have come to a screeching halt, that will be the profoundest of influences. That's what he says. Calls to Kids Helpline over the past year have skyrocketed. 70% of those calls are from girls. The only recorded drop in terms of issues was recorded in the category of bullying. So what's our role as educators and mentors? And could we provide the game changer this generation is desperately seeking? In the past 3 years, I've interviewed thousands of tween and teen girls, a similar number of parents, along with dozens and dozens of school principals and teachers and counsellors, psychologists, CEOs and parenting experts. And together that's resulted in three books, Being 14, Fathers and Daughters, and more recently, Teenager. In addition, I've addressed close to 100 school parent communities and received too many emails to count. I'm not an educator or a psychologist. My two teen daughters would confirm that I'm not a parenting expert either. I'm a journalist, trained to ask questions and analyse what I'm told. And listening to Alexia and Anya and Tanya and Eve and all the other girls who've allowed me into their lives, tomorrow's leaders are asking for the help of today's. They're asking for our help to be heard on consent laws and climate change. They're asking to be heard on the anxiety that is crippling too many of them, on the pressure they feel, often a pressure they put on themselves. And I think they've wrapped themselves in a blanket of irony that we need to help shed. They want independence, but find solace in a clearly defined and exclusive friendship group where they know the attributes of a good friend, but struggle to put that into practice. They want to take on the world, but too many of them put a ceiling on their own potential in a way their brothers don't. They are non-judgmental of their friends' decisions often, and then absolutely brutal in their self-judgment. They can see the way ahead, often cleared too well by their parents, and yet they want to race outside their lane and into the lane of the girl next to them. They want to lead and make room for Black lives and transgender lives and LGBTIQ lives and all sorts of lives. But then they wonder where they might fit in there. Are they taking the place of someone more deserving? Do they have a responsibility to speak up for others? Or by doing that, are they muting the voice of others? At home, their ability, often delivered by you, to speak out with conviction and clarity, to beat the boys at debating and earn top marks in persuasive speaking is celebrated. Until they speak out, particularly against the views of Dad. Don't be stupid. That's a comment too many of the girls attributed to Dad when their views cross the family views on everything from politics to sexuality. They strive too much for perfection, I think, and focus too much on what they see as their own imperfections. So where do they sit? And what's our role in guiding them in public debate and engaging with families? I could pick a dozen issues that have jumped out to me in the girls' stories, but just let me address five ironies where they've been delivered enormous opportunity, but perhaps not been able to make the most of those. And my first one is so clear at 10, is that in trying to embrace independence, they land in this big vat of groupthink. In reorienting themselves away from their family, as is natural, they're wanting to look and think like everyone else. But what I found heartbreaking, though, in interviewing 10-year-olds is that they want to change those things they can't. It's so hard when it's something like the colour of their skin or their height. That's Brisbane Girls Grammar School psychologist Tara McLaughlin. And I think it starts at 10. They just want to fit in and be like everyone else. You know, the two most commonly mentioned words by 10-year-olds to me were fitting in. They want to look like the girl at the next desk, same ponytail, same height. It's safer. But we want them to be the antithesis of that, don't we? Brave and strong and curious. Too often they believe they're not enough, but it must be so hard for them not to judge themselves when they hear their friends judging themselves. Sometimes I feel like I don't fit in, but I don't know why, Rose told me. I don't fit in because my friends have changed, Jenny said. This isn't just at 10, which is why I think we need to consider how we might help address this. Being 14 is confusing and a mix of emotions. Sometimes you want to lock yourself in a room for years, and sometimes it's the most carefree and fun time you could imagine. That's Tracy, who I interviewed for my book, Being 14. Paris, also 14, told me this: I'm constantly conflicted about decision making. Girls describe a life of irony in those years 8 or 9. Until then, they didn't articulate it. But at 13 and 14, they describe a life that's perfect one moment and pathetic the next. Friends who are regularly online tormentors, connected 24/7 and often feeling utterly, utterly alone. Ironies galore. There is no doubt our girls want to lead and want to win. They want to follow in the shoes of women who have made great steps forward in their generation, female prime ministers in Australia and New Zealand. They are feisty and opinionated. They want to raise money for the right causes and right the wrongs they see. But then they find themselves stuck in a vat of groupthink, not daring to be different from everyone around them. I don't know who I am anymore, Polly told me. Emily said this: being 14 is absolutely horrible. It's when, at least for me, you start to question everything and your life starts to crumble. But it was Alison who threw the question back to me. It's difficult, she said. Can you tell us whether we're supposed to be adults or kids? Because sometimes we're treated as one and then the other. This irony is fed by that smartphone. You know, our girls are so much older, so much younger. They're exposed to a world of information, but information often they don't understand. Take this example: in a group of 10-year-olds at a big all-girls school only a couple of weeks ago, a year 6 student handed her peers a piece of paper divided into 3 columns. Do you like wearing dresses? Do you like wearing shorts? Do you like wearing dresses and shorts? One young girl, whose imagination still includes her pet dragon, ticked, I like wearing dresses and shorts. The verdict she was then given publicly was that she was bisexual. Is there any wonder she's now refusing to play netball because she has to wear shorts? I can't help thinking that in this search for identity, coupled with a broader acceptance of sexuality and a focus on the importance of minority voices, some decisions are playing out too early for our girls. They can't articulate it at 10, but they painted a picture of trying to navigate a field of cancel culture. Black lives matter, but more or less than their own. Gender neutrality, is it okay, but is it relevant to me? Being transgender was the new black, one 12-year-old girl recently told a psychiatrist, who is shaking his head at what is happening. Too many parents, fearful they'll damage their children if they don't act, are asking about sex change operations, he said, before their child's 13th birthday. Our girls are living in a world of opportunity and broadening acceptance when it comes to who they want to be, but how do they make those decisions? And based on what information? By listening to what they're told on TikTok? By listening to older girls who in some schools are running unofficial membership drives in lower grades? Too much of this is coming back to that desperate need to fit in that search for independence. They're caught in that vat of groupthink. I want to look like Katie, one girl told me. Why, I asked. And she could not give me an answer other than she looked awesome. How do we help them stand confidently aside from the pack? Should we be celebrating difference more? Help them understand the individual journey they're on? At the start of year 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, they are all on the same starting block. And they're all going to finish that year at the end of the same pool. But they need to understand how they get to the end of their pool is their decision. Freestyle or backstroke? Go like a bat out of hell and win? Or dog paddle? Stop and chat with the girl in the next lane and swim together as a team? Or give up and get out of the pool? Keep going and learn to do butterfly well? But the one thing they can't do, because it's cheating, is to swim in the lane of the girl next to them. They need to see that. I think they need to understand that visually. I sought the advice of 100 middle school teachers in researching Teenager, and the biggest challenge facing the girls sitting in front of them each day, almost unanimously, was a lack of self-confidence. Self-confidence, one teacher said. Confidence in self, another said. Self-esteem, self-identity, and so it went on. How they see themselves, identity, self-worth, acceptance of self. Why, I ask? Because they're managing the expectations of parents and peers, navigating an online world where feeds are brimming with what they believe they are not, and that newfound determination to look outside of their families to see who they are. And I think that leads them to fit in and be like everyone else. Professor George Patton tells educators that they have a wonderful opportunity when the girls are as young as 7 or 8. He says those early stages of puberty are as invisible as they are profound. Now, this is really important age, he said, where we may be able to change trajectories. A child begins to develop a sense of who they want to be in the world. This is the beginning of that search for identity. It's where they land that provides the irony. And according to Professor Patton, it's a time when concerns about body image will first emerge. Children, he says, attending mental health services at the age of 15 and 16 have almost always had mental health issues at the ages of 7 and 8. We need to spread that word. For half of their life, they've had these problems, he said, so we're not really doing early intervention. We're missing the boat. His research, now being used around the globe, might help teachers understand, he says, something they can't really put their finger on, but that takes hold in years 3 and 4. Teachers are important figures in the lives of kids, he says. In terms of teaching and kids reorienting themselves to the wider world, this is an incredible opportunity for educators to provide and guide that. In refocusing away from family, some girls also choose at this point to work less or to shun being a good girl. This all points to how crucial that mid-primary age is to how girls will be a few years later. If you wanted to create the Ash Barty of the next generation, you could invest in all you could afford in the first 3 years of life, Professor Patton told me, and never, ever get Ash Barty. But if you invest in the age of 7 or 8, when the motor cortex is actually developing, if you invest then in tennis lessons and training, you might just get an Ash Barty because that's the sensitive time of them developing. Surely that has relevance to when we really hone in on consent, but more on that later. I'll end this irony here, but many of you spoke to me as part of my research, and thank you. And I have things you've said plastered all over my house for my own girls. This one is from school principal Kim Amor. I asked her if she was given a wand and one magic spell, what would she give to every 10-year-old girl? Her answer, a personal superpower that allows them to retain their inner beauty and innocence, vulnerability and hope, whilst able to provide a force field of strength, courage, determination, grit and resilience. That would allow them to know their self-worth, stand true to their beliefs and always aspire to fulfill their own aspirations. Thanks for that, Kim. So let me move to my second irony, where girls can have 1,000 friends and not a soul to talk to. Inspector John Rouse heads Task Force Argos, and for the last couple of decades, he's tracked down online pedophiles grooming or abusing children. How many Instagram followers should I allow my 14-year-old to have, I asked him. He threw the question back at me. What about if you planned a pool party for your 14-year-old, he said. You printed the invitation, handed it to her, and then said, sweetie, here's an invitation for a party on Friday night. Give it to your closest 1,000 friends. It wouldn't happen, would it? But routinely, girls in their mid-teens have 1,000 Insta followers. Do you know if a teen has 650 friends on one social media app and each of those friends have 500, that means conceivably 325,000 people are able to contact her. Those figures aren't mine. They come from someone, a former police officer, who works investigating football recruits. Her job is to look at their social media profile to see if a club wants to take them. What would happen, Inspector Rouse went on, if one of your daughter's friends turned up on your doorstep at 9:30 p.m. and asked to chat with her? Would you welcome her in or bundle her into a car and take her home? So why are so many children allowed on phones and social media at that time? It leads to bullying and exclusion and bad decision-making, as you know. Being left on read is now the big one when children first get a phone. Half of the 1,600 mothers I surveyed in Teenager said their child at 10 now had a smartphone. Lockdown has boosted those figures because parents wanted their children to stay in touch with others. So back to being left on read. For those who aren't familiar, this is what happens. A girl sends a text to a friend at night. The sender sees the red receipt but doesn't receive a reply. By morning, it can be war. The message recipient, who might have been half asleep or not allowed to answer, is deemed responsible for her friend being left on read. Now let's park bullying and half-naked selfies and even the risk of online grooming. I wonder if we need to rethink the narrative around smartphones in a few ways. Firstly, to take the blame away from girls and put it squarely at their parents. No parent is giving their 16-year-old the keys to the family car and telling her to take it for a spin without lessons. Why is the narrative around smartphones, which might be just as dangerous in some ways, be any different? The problem is not the phone. It's how it's used or misused. The second area I'd love to consider is whether we prioritise the opportunity cost of what our girls are missing out on when they're on their phones. What would a year 6 or a year 11 student be doing between 7 and 8 p.m. tonight if they don't have their phone? That phone offers them the world. And then in an irony, it steals so much from them. White space, spare time, time reading and laughing and talking. We need to start asking that question, stop constantly to the girls, but also their parents. What would we all be doing if we weren't on our phones? But it was the third area where this irony really stood out to me. So connected, but too often they're feeling utterly alone. That smartphone has changed how friendship is navigated, and the mass loss of socialization skills, where I think so many young girls don't know how to be a friend, is what I saw repeatedly in my latest research. It underpins so much, including what you and I hold dear as mature women, friends who have our back, who understand us, who provide wise counsel, friendships built up over years and years and years. Friendship is really hard, one 10-year-old told me. I was sitting with a new group and I'm shy, so they thought I didn't like them. And then the bossy girl told me to leave. My friends liked me last year, but now they're too cool for me, another said. Is that friendship? In theory, 10-year-olds nail the attributes of a good friend. Being kind and being funny were the two most important things to them. Our girls are struggling, though, with the tools of friendship. Practicing it proved very difficult. This is something I think different from our generation and even the generation of girls who might now be turning 20. One mother asked me this: why do some girls become so unkind and mean or nasty at this age? A second mother says all she wants is to be loved. She gets so frustrated and upset because it doesn't come easily, and she assumes reasons like she has hairier legs or she isn't pretty. From a third mother, she loves the idea of having friends but struggles to cross over from being friendly to actually being real friends. Now, it's easy at 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 to send an emoji. Now, perhaps even at 10, it's harder to navigate a bond that requires patience and forgiveness and difference and time to blossom. On the expert advice I received, we need to relook at the basics of friendship. And I know this is a parental role, but it's not being taught at home. Here's just three things that stood out to me. One, our girls need to learn how not to exclude others and to value forgiveness when one of their peers makes a mistake. We've all had arguments with friends, but the friendship survives because it is bigger than the argument. Now it's one strike and you're out, aided by parents who tell their children not to mix with someone who's done the wrong thing. One mother explained to me how her daughter had no friends after doing something wrong, and her friend's parents encouraging their children not to forgive that misdemeanor. My second point is this: real life friendships are an antidote to the online influencer market, where someone like Selena Gomez's handbag can get 4 million likes. Children need to understand boundaries better. What will they accept or what won't they accept in a friendship? And whether they're 6 or 16, they need to make that decision away from their friends in the cold light of day. And thirdly, they need to learn the language to communicate that to their friends. We say to our kids, just do this, expecting they're going to have the words, one expert told me. They don't. They need to practice the phrases and learn to use them in those tricky moments. Finally, I just want to park this thought. How is this issue, the smartphone, going to play out in the next 5 years when young parents increasingly have their own relationship with social media? As chair of the state cyberbullying task force 2 years ago now, I heard children who went without dinner because mum was on Facebook. As educators, you are now dealing with an issue that is enveloping your students, but also many of their parents. Your influence on the former is huge. And what a privileged position we have in trying to shed that irony, where they'll have hundreds and hundreds of friends on Snapchat and yet no one to sit with at lunchtime. My third irony comes down to the behaviour our girls are experiencing and witnessing. Everything's changed, but really nothing has changed. And the best example of that is the current consent discussion being waged nationally in Australia. Brittany Higgins shone a light on something we knew was an issue. As a young reporter, I can remember a politician promising me a good story if I slept with him. Thank God my comeback was, why don't we ask your wife and make it a threesome? I got the story without the sex. But I've had bosses proposition me, try to kiss me, and on one occasion tear my top off. It hasn't impacted me, except I know when I feel real fear, I can't scream. My mouth opens and nothing comes out. enough of me, because I think most of us probably have a story. Brittany Higgins told hers, and hopefully there will be some change. But we know that while our girls have been promised equality, nothing has changed. More than 4,000 brave and strong teen Australian girls put their names to assaults and rapes by peers. And you know, we haven't heard one word about it from our political leadership. Let me just focus on that for 10 more seconds. Thousands of teen girls allege sexual assault and rape, and the Australian Prime Minister has not seen fit to comment on it at all. Boys have, though. Comments to girls run from "rape is bad, but it's not that bad," to "it's because of women like you that men want to kill themselves," to "typical girls exaggerating." The equality promised is not being delivered, is it? You work so hard here, so, so hard, but it is not being replicated in boys' schools, bar a few. It's not being remodeled in workplaces, public or private, bar a few. It's equality in theory, not practice. But it's not only how boys' schools are dealing or not dealing with respect issues. Sadly, I think it's how sons and daughters are being treated still is part of the problem here. Experts told me that fathers continue to treat their daughters as more fragile than their sons. Girls told me how dad cried when they left for boarding school, but to their brothers, he'd say, "off you go." A father's role in role modelling when it comes to expectations around a partner is huge. He sets the bar. But there's another area where I think we need to encourage dads and father figures to help make the promised equality a reality. A father can build a daughter's self-esteem and give her a self-belief that will really help her, but he can crush it just as quickly. Too many dads, I think, are demolishing arguments posed by their daughters, who then take that as him believing she's not smart. She sees it as a put-down. Dad just says, "I'm wrong when I try to say what I think, so I don't bother anymore." That's one girl. Or I just go quiet. I try and say something like on refugees and he slaps my argument down. Or why bother? I'm not allowed to have an independent view and I'm not about to agree with Dad and his views on same-sex marriage. That might not surprise you, but the irony here is staggering. Girls are being schooled to have convictions, analyze the different sides of an argument, to find the supporting evidence, and then to prosecute it with passion and clarity. In the school context, in debating and public speaking, fathers applaud it. But then the girls go home, and in many cases, their father, as the girls tell it, object when their views conflict with their dad's. That stood out to me in researching fathers and daughters. We need to teach girls to speak out with respect, but we also need to engage their families, particularly, I think, their fathers, to understand that she is just starting to feel that she can take him on intellectually, and she's trying to work out how her mind works and what her values are. She's thinking out loud to him, and that is a privilege. No doubt exists that we can speak up more too as female leaders, apply pressure so that more females run male schools, more mothers take up positions on school boards, that we show fathers how important it is for their girls to be heard, and for those of us with sons to actually ask the schools they attend to detail what they are doing in the areas of respect and consent. It's easy to say something. The proof is usually in the pudding. We can also speak up too, I think, to show girls it's okay to do that. That's what one educator did recently, and I'm doing this with her permission. Sue Havers is the head of All Hallows Senior School in Brisbane, and she used the school newsletter to argue that speaking up ourselves gave our daughters the license to do the same. When the people closest to them share their own stories, she said, it removes the embarrassment and shame they're feeling, and they're more likely to share. And then she told her story, which is probably similar to so many of ours. She was young, a beginning teacher at a school swimming carnival, when her new principal made her crawl over him to get out of a viewing van. As I passed over his lap, he pulled me down so that I was sitting, his hands everywhere. It was only a few seconds, but it felt like a lifetime, she told parents in the newsletter. I had no idea what to do. I had no family close, brand new to a town. This man was larger than life and everyone appeared to like him. Maybe I had caused it because I was in PE gear. Maybe I had no right to ask him to move because he was the principal. Maybe he was just joking. What did I know? I was young. It was the longest year of my life. Every time he called me to his office to review my work programs, I would panic. I lasted the year and then I got transferred out. Thank you, Sue. I mean, telling that story has empowered girls who have been discussing it, encouraging their mothers to read it and discussing it more broadly. Intergenerational activism, she says, is extremely powerful. I know I've focused on consent, but this irony means this promised equality is being swamped by a systemic failure to deliver, and it's costing our daughters and students happiness. You know, we encourage them into STEM, but no matter what is said, the jobs have not been there to allow similar levels of employment. We say you can reach for the stars, and then we see the breakdown of women and men who receive Australia Day awards or board positions or who win political pre-selections. We've got women's sport onto TV, from AFL to soccer to surfing, but look at how much female athletes are paid compared to their peers. Promising equality is easy. It's us holding those people to account that will allow the girls to capitalise on the opportunities rather than be drowned out by the challenges. My fourth irony, and I promise I'm only going to do five, is the unlimited potential a teen girl now has, but how quickly she can put a ceiling on that in a way her male peers don't. You know, we've helped dismantle ceilings so our girls can see the stars. But how do we get them to believe they can reach for them too? The unlimited potential being offered to this generation of girls is quite remarkable. Classes in everything, extracurricular activities we never dreamt of, university places and scholarships for those whose families are challenged by income or geography. But despite that, girls are closing off options too early. They're listening to the messages of those around them, focusing on the verdicts delivered via social media, and it's moulding their paths. Too often, instead of widening the road ahead, they narrow it. "I'm not a science girl," Jimmy told me. "I can't do maths," Sonny said. "Just 3 more years of science, then you only do science if you're a science girl," another said. Science girls? Maths girls? "We don't even know what they're capable of," at 10, one neuroscientist told me. So how do they? Why do our girls put such a low ceiling on their own potential? Most experts put this down to expectations. Their parents, yes, sometimes their teachers, but principally their own. And this is a real difference between boys and girls, from what I was told. Girls felt, one educator said, that even in a small group of 4 or 5, if they sit in the bottom in terms of marks, the message is clear. "I'm not a smart girl. I won't be doing maths and science in high school." They put a ceiling on their own potential. The president of the International Association of Adolescent Health is Professor Susan Sawyer, and she sees two additional causes for this type of thinking. The first, believe it or not, is the gendered views of what boys and girls do in families. And it is so sad that we're still seeing that as an issue, but we are. I gave you the example of 14-year-old girls saying goodbye to their dad before heading off to boarding school. It also surfaced strongly in fathers and daughters over dads being overprotective. Girls told stories of their fathers' escapades at their age, and then when they asked to go shopping on Thursday night, the request was denied. Many girls believe their fathers parent by gender, that they're treated differently because they are girls, and their fathers see them as more vulnerable or weaker than their brothers. "My father trusts my brothers more in the outside world," says Kylie. "He believes they can look after themselves." Fathers don't flinch at the suggestion that they parent their sons and daughters in diverse ways. They agree. Here's a snapshot of answers to this question. If you have a son, is there a difference in how you parent him compared to your daughter? "Yes, I expect different things from him than I do from girls." Or, "Yes, he's a boy, I'm less protective." Or, "Yes, there's always more to worry about with a daughter." That should send up alarm bells for all of us, because it can limit a girl's ability to judge risk, develop critical thinking skills, even just live life. The overprotective father can really damage the self-efficacy of his daughter. That's one New Zealand educator. Treating a girl as being more vulnerable than her brother can actually lead to her becoming more vulnerable, he said. It starts a belief structure in their heads. So those gendered views can help close the ceiling we've lifted for girls. Professor Sawyer said another cause is also girls internalising things. I was 8 when my maths teacher said I was hopeless at maths. This is a New Zealand school counsellor talking to me. And she said, my mother said, oh yeah, she's just like me. I was never good at maths either. And so the counsellor said she was never going to be good at maths. I was steered back repeatedly here to the girls' search for identity. You know, them taking on the messages of those around them and those messages quickly closing off options. And I know this is a generalisation, but this is not the case with boys often. One deputy principal of a co-ed school told me that if he asked a girl why she says she's not a maths person, she'll say, I'm not good at it. Boys weren't like that, he said, because they didn't take the results personally. It was a mark on the page often. And he provides this analogy. If a boy was told he'd made a mistake at football, he'd think he didn't kick the ball well in that particular match. It wouldn't become an issue of him as a person. A girl, however, would be likely to take that mistake personally. That knowledge of what is required for success and the early pressure to achieve, Professor James Scott, a lead child psychiatrist, believes is behind the high levels of anxiety you're now seeing among young girls, not boys. Girls were more worried about what others thought, he said, and this was growing. I think there's much more of an awareness of the need to do well academically, he said. He said it was partly driven by parental expectation, along with our girls being aware of what is expected of them later in life and how success is seen. And in his words, he said to me, it is a burden our girls are now carrying. Could this lowering of our own expectations or lowering that ceiling be part of a girl's drive towards perfectionism? I think they start to become afraid of failing, one school principal told me. If they can't do it perfectly, why bother? Another principal who is probably listening today wonders if girls are now limiting their potential in pursuit of always being happy. And I love this insight. We have this expectation that we're meant to be happy and that means no discomfort. She wonders if the message should be that we need to be happy on balance and that achievements can be gained by putting ourselves outside of our comfort zones. It's only a small jump from the pursuit of happiness to the pursuit of perfectionism. So what does this educator see in her all-girls school? What you start to find is that girls think they have to be perfect, and that shows itself at school. This might mean, for example, that a child will not hand in work where they've been forced to cross something out. They can't present it because it's not perfect. The next step is that if they believe they can't complete it perfectly, they don't. So they don't hand in the work, she says. Then they can say to themselves, I didn't get good marks because I didn't do it, not because I did it and it wasn't up to scratch. That type of insight which you bring as educators is so important to how parent communities see the education of their girls. How might we as parents learn more of that from you and in the process ensure our girls aren't only offered the world, but they feel as though they can grab it with both hands too? So my final irony for today is this. The world is their oyster, but it's a world they'd rather view from the comfort of Instagram. One mother told me the story of her 13-year-old who promised to rise early and watch sunrise over Burleigh Heads Hill with her at Easter. Her mother woke her daughter, who said this, Mum, you go, I'll just Google it later. Sunrise. The irony, we know screens are robbing children of playtime, but the impact on their fitness, which is what I want to focus on here, is huge. Research shows that if you lined up the 10-year-olds at your school and allowing for time travel, they competed with their parents as 10-year-olds, their mums and dads would win a 1.6-kilometre race by 90 seconds. Their parents should hear that. Back to this research in a moment, but Mark McCrindle, the social demographer, says a 10-year-old girl is in many ways a metaphor for the future. They're almost a lens, he said. They're living this future before we even see it. having had screens as pacifiers since birth, their world is different even from the Gen Z big sisters. So for this post-key, post-cash generation, the world has moved from written to visual media, aka Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, and the muscular influence it has. Globally connected, that digital literacy risks stunting their social growth, and that means they might not be well equipped to live life as their parents were. Going for a bushwalk or camping, or even getting a campfire organised, is something that is beyond the skills of many, Mark McCrindle told me. Courses and school excursions have replaced childhood adventures. That's partly a reflection of the way we parent, but I think also a change in the makeup of our cities and the lure of medium and high density living, which has killed off big backyards. Life is more structured, and after school tutoring, soccer training, gymnastics has replaced the free play of earlier generations. So the opportunity cost of what girls are missing out on while attached to their screens delivers the irony here. And the example I want to give is in their fitness levels. In researching Teenager, I spent time with Dr. Gavin Sandercock from the University of Essex, and his research is into finding how fit and strong how our 10-year-olds are. He and his team set about looking at same-age children in the same school year on year. They tested when the children were 10 and again at 16, instructing them to undertake a bunch of strength tests from sit-ups to dangling from monkey bars. 350 kids in UK schools were involved, half were girls. Height, weight, BMI, waist measurement were all scaled so children could be compared to those a decade ago. So Dr. Sandercock knew from official data that 10-year-olds had grown bigger over time and that more of them were falling into the obese category. But what about fitness? How fast could they run? How strong were they? The results are fascinating. Girls are 2.5 centimetres taller than they were 16 years ago at the age of 10, and so much weaker. Their raw strength on simple things like a pinch grip test, which required no skill, was down to 10 to 15%, while their ability on exercise that took effort, like timed sit-ups, was down 45%. But it was one result that really stood out to me. Children were required to hang by their hands from a gym bar, carrying their own weight, holding their legs at a 90-degree angle with their knees bent. They were placed in that position, and then the instructor took a step back. This is what Sandercock said. That's the only one where we couldn't get them all to do it because 30% of children refused or simply couldn't do the test. It was dangerous for them to do it because their grip was so poor and their arms so weak. Compared to their body weight, they would just fall off. 16 years ago, every child scored on that test, which was conducted in exactly the same way. So many children just couldn't do it. What about when you climb trees? Dr. Sandercock asked them. I don't climb trees, they responded. What about when you play on the monkey bars in the park? Their answer was the same. Says Sandercock, it was just something that has been lost or is becoming lost. That means many children at 10 are missing out on the immediate health benefits of being fit and strong and flexible. But it also reduces their ability to join in and participate in sport. His study is seminal to a discussion, I think, on hobbies and habits, particularly sport, because this is the age when children often decide to pursue a team sport with more vigour or drop it. What concerns him, though, is the bracket creep here. The changes are subtle and happen over time. Infrastructure like monkey bars is disappearing from parks at the same time the rush to climb trees is waning. He says helicopter parenting is a background factor here, but also schools being fearful of being sued if a child falls. Australian research has pointed to a disparity here between girls and boys. A study in Canberra found that 8-year-old girls are less likely to take part in extracurricular sport than boys and took 2,000 fewer steps per day. Overall, girls were 19% less active than boys, had poorer cardiorespiratory fitness and hand-eye coordination, and had a higher percentage of body fat. It sounds counterintuitive, teacher and author Daisy Turnbull says, to say that the longer you let kids be kids, the better they will adult, but it is true. She says the more kids are allowed to play in mud, create games, and develop their own solutions to problems, the more they will thrive as they grow older. Former Matilda and Olympian Joey Peters agrees, saying there should be no age limit on play and our use of that word. As adults, it seems foreign, she said, but we should all play. Several experts urged educators like you to continue to encourage play well beyond the age of 10 and to call it that because of its therapeutic effect on anxiety, self-regulation, dealing with trauma even, and just killing off childhood prematurely. And it's only one example of that irony there, but I think a really important one. So in finishing, what's our role here? My thesis is simple. We've delivered so much to and for girls, but they're struggling to capitalize on it. And that's where we need, I think, to focus our attention and perhaps maybe even mold our own roles. Do we need to be a bit louder or our message to travel a bit further? That can be uncomfortable, I know, particularly in the roles you have. But so too is doing everything you do and our girls not receiving the full benefit of it. I think we need to be more involved in the narrative around issues impacting on those we teach, around domestic violence and childcare and consent, so they're not seen as women's issues, that they're just as much men's issues. And on issues like curriculum, NAPLAN, tax on tampons, league tables of education results and sex education. It's starting, I know. I love seeing Dr. Bryony Scott or Paulina Skirman or last night, Jacinda Euler on the drum and her lovely friends from BGGS. But why not elsewhere and more of us? Panel discussions on the national broadcaster, broader communication in our newsletters, school boards that play it brave, not safe. You know, we ask our daughters and nieces and students to find strong female role models. Hopefully, we are those. But like everything else in the world, disruption brings change. And that's just as relevant to us in how we use our positions. And it is in any curriculum review that will land in your email. Thank you and good luck with both of those things. And now I'll hand back to you.
Hi there, Madonna. Thank you for such a terrific session. And hello, everyone. I'm Lauren Bridge, the Executive Officer of the Alliance, and I'm going to be facilitating the Q&A with a little bit of help from my builders next door. Sorry about that. Madonna, I could listen to you for hours, and it's just so fascinating to hear what's on the minds of girls, and you've managed to capture their voice so brilliantly. You mentioned that for your books, Teenagers, Being 14 and Fathers and Daughters, that you interviewed thousands of girls, parents and educators. So based on all of that research, where do you think the biggest opportunity is for schools to engage with parents?
I think there's probably many, but I think there's two. One is dads. I think they are a massively underestimated resource. Many of them themselves see themselves as more the provider than the parent. You know that they are able to reduce anxiety and the drama sometimes around girls' arguments and the like. But dads routinely explained to me that they didn't feel as welcome on school grounds as perhaps their wives did. I think if we could engage them and get them to understand their absolute power in relation to girls, then they would be on board quicker and they would be a fantastic resource for schools. And if I can just give one example, and that is in the area of consent and respect. We know that girls will develop expectations of their partner later through what they see and how dad or father figures treat their mothers, irrespective of whether they live with them, their brothers, sisters, mothers, and the like. We need to teach dads that they have that power, that they set the bar, and then tell them to set the bar as high as they like. And I think that one thing could fundamentally change how consent and respect is seen. The other in, I think, is in those parents who want to get into your school. So if your school starts in year 5 or year 7, every parent wants to do the right thing. So, you know, in Teenager, I have noticed, I've been talking around the country and in New Zealand last night, which was beautiful, via Zoom and in person. But you know where the much bigger audience is, and I'm talking hundreds, is years three and four parents when they want to get into year five out of school. So those schools have cleverly marketed to all those parents who have applied to that school. And they all want to go because they want to see the principal here. They want to know what happens at the school. They want to know what the school is thinking. And I think if you drew up a strategy, a marketing plan that went to dads and your prospective enrolled parents, it's just two areas where I think there is quite strong opportunity, Lauren.
Thank you. And I guess following on from that, you mentioned, of course, seeing Jacinta Isler on the drum last night, which was, I think, terrific for all girls' schools, and Paulina Skirman, who's a regular, and Bryony Scott as well. So are you actually saying that educators and school leaders need to speak out more and beyond the school gate?
Yeah, and I know some of you listening will think, and not just educators broadly, I know you'll think, well, that's not our role. I know you've got to walk this fine line between parents and politics and funding and everything. But the voice of senior educators is what is missing across the board. It's missing in consent, and it's missing in the curriculum review. It's missing in how girls are being viewed, and it's missing in domestic violence. But it is so important because you have this knowledge and this insight that our politicians don't have, that our parents don't have, that I don't have. And it's by listening to you that I think we could massage public debate and public policy. How you do that is difficult. So certainly I think in talking to parents, and, you know, I hate to say it, but I'm not sure they all read the newsletter. So is it more directly, for example? I know some schools are starting to send out letters in relation to sleep to specific families about the importance of sleep. Do you need a more direct messaging to some of your parents? And it is the principal who is speaking, not a board-in speaker, because I think that impacts on parents quite strongly. Is it in an opinion piece for the local newspaper or a website? Is it, and you said Jacinda and Paulina and Bryony, I have noticed, like Bryony started to write for the Sydney Morning Herald, which I think is fantastic. What are the papers in Auckland where they are wanting content? Is it the Catholic Leader? You know, do you think outside the square? Because I know in this role, they are constantly wanting content. It's where they get it from. And if they don't know you're available, I think it's really difficult for them to pick up a phone and think, all right, I'm going to ask the principal of this school whether she'd like to participate in this debate on Radio National. It doesn't have to be a debate either. You know, an interview that just explains things to us. My last thing is, because why this is so important, and as a mother, I find this almost something that brings me to tears. But when you have thousands of teen girls saying they've been assaulted or raped by peers, and it just drowns, it just disappears as an issue, we have a real problem. If we're talking about royal commissions, that's where it should be directed to. You know, where is the questioning of boys' schools and how they're addressing this? Because we know girls' schools are. But unless we hear that from you in some way, in a respectful way that doesn't upset some of your parents, you know, it could be in who you elect to school boards or how your marketing is run or in your business plan over the next 3 years to envelop a greater view within the school. I think those things are really important to our girls using Forward, because it uses this terrific insight that you have and not a lot of other people do.
I couldn't agree with you more there, Madonna. And, yeah, it certainly is appalling, I think the silence that we've heard from boys' schools in direct response to girls' schools. I mean, I know that some boys have given some very impassioned speeches, but maybe more for YouTube audiences than actually for the girls.
Or, and can I say this? Yes, Lauren, you're exactly right. And, you know, so a boy says it, and good on him, but can I ask why we're celebrating that? Shouldn't that be the view of every male peer? When one of my daughters said, you know, when we all got up and marched around our school perimeter on this, what she would have loved is the local boys' school joining in. And I think, you know, I think boys' schools, and I'm not shy about saying this, are so worried about keeping bequeathments and protecting their brand that they're risking the good character of 99% of their students who are respectful, honest, lovely boys, but they're not willing to protect them. They're willing to protect their brand faster. And I think, you know, in Australia, I'm not sure about New Zealand, in Australia, I think that's just so disappointing.
It seriously is, and I could talk on that topic for ages, but let's get to one of our questions. Girls are raised to be compliant and perform for others, creating anxiety. Generally, boys are encouraged to achieve, conquer, and are championed. Girls and women are raised with the human giver syndrome. We must sacrifice for the benefit of others, mostly boys and men. Many of my female students don't know how to say no and can carry guilt for not pleasing others.
Mm. So Andrew Fuller, I interviewed a psychologist from Melbourne in Teenager, and he says exactly that. And he says he gets 10-year-old girls to stand opposite each other and one has to shout no as loud as they can to the other till she's convinced they mean it, and then they swap positions. But you know what he said to me? It's the first time some of those girls have ever emphatically said no in their life, and he sees the consequences of that acquiescence a few years later. Look how parents describe their girls on Facebook. You know, we say, oh, isn't she pretty? You know, when she's 3 and 4 and 5, look at her hair. What a lovely tiara. And, you know, there's a boy running through mud and we say, oh, what a little adventure seeker. What a tough little bloke. And I think we have to change the narrative around all of that. But I think, you know, it's two steps forward, one step back.
It is hard. And I encourage anyone who's after some answers to that question, how to teach girls to say no, to listen to Lisa Damore's session that was on earlier today. It will be on demand later. She gave some specific strategies for actually how to say no and not feel bad about it. And I'll be taking some of those up myself. Here's another question, perhaps more of a comment, but my husband has taught my children how to banter with him since they were quite young. The aim was for something more intellectual rather than toilet talk. I was always annoyed by it, thinking it was disrespectful. Well, they went a little bit overboard sometimes. Now I recognise that my children can stand up in an argument with their dad and do it much better than I can. They have developed these skills over time. I remember doing this with my dad only a little, but I wonder what's happened in the meantime.
Yeah, what a great contribution. Thank you. And I think that goes to this point of the power of dads and the influence they can have.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you found Madonna's presentation informative and thought-provoking. And I do hope you'll share this podcast with your colleagues and help us to amplify girls' voices and awareness for the issues affecting girls and girls' education. Please click follow to stay updated as we add new episodes to this podcast.